You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 11 of a series in the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 17, verse 1. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarrelled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to these people? They are almost ready to stone me." The Lord answered Moses, "Go out in front of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock and the water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massah and Meribah because the Israelites quarrelled and they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Now this account obviously echoes and parallels the account of the Israelites grumbling about the food that they didn't have. Are we going to starve to death in the desert? Are we now going to thirst or die of thirst or drought in the desert? Of course, it's a story of grumbling, a story of quarrelling with Moses, of grumbling about God, a story of lack of faith. It's a sad story. And the dynamic is the same. Moses cries out to the Lord and asks what he's to do. But notice the Lord says, "Take the elders of Israel with you and stand at the rock by Horeb." Significantly, Horeb is another name for Mount Sinai. And so this is the place, or they're very close to the place, where God is going to give the law to Moses, which of course is what we're building up to in Exodus at this point. But God provides for Israel. The elders are to go with Moses. There's a corporate dimension here. Yes, Moses is the leader, but the elders are standing with him, perhaps as witnesses, perhaps so that they can convince and lead the people. And the staff is involved, the same staff that was involved in striking the Nile, it tells us. So it's not just that the staff was raised up. This is the staff that Moses had, rather, and he used it in those plagues when God brought them out of Egypt. He's to strike the rock and the water will come out, and he does it. And the place gets named Massah, which means testing, and Meribah, which means quarrelling, because the people quarrelled and tested God and asked whether Yahweh was among them or not. And it seems that their testing is to see whether God will remain faithful to them. That's the big question that they're facing. Is God going to stick with them? Not so much that they're questioning whether God has been with them, but they're expecting that at some point God is going to abandon them and walk away. Let's read on then, verse 8 of Exodus 17. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of our men and go to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands." So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on each one side, one on the other, so that his hands remained steady until sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven." Moses built an altar and called it, "The Lord is my banner." He said, "Because hands were lifted up against the throne of the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation." This is an interesting account because the Israelites are fighting now for the first time. God delivered them from the Egyptians without a battle, but here the Amalekites attack them and they have to fight against the Amalekites. and Joshua becomes the leader. He is, of course, a great general. He'll continue to lead the people after Moses' death, and he'll be the one who leads them to their victories as they enter the promised land. But the victory here, and it's very clearly so, is from God. Moses has to hold up his hands to God, and he needs assistance to do that. If he needed the elders of Israel to stand with him as he struck the rock, now he needs Aaron and Hur to hold up his hands to sustain him through his prayer vigil. The Amalekites, of course, are descendants of Amalek, who was the one of the grandsons of Esau. So they're also descendants of Abraham, descendants of Isaac, his other son Esau. And so it's very sad that here they, who are distantly related to the Israelites, attack the Israelites. They try to take advantage. The Amalekites, probably much more familiar with the terrain, with desert warfare. They haven't lived most of their lives in slavery the way the Israelites have, and so you would expect them to have the military advantage. But of course God ensures the victory, but only as far as Moses lifts up his hands. And perhaps I think the significance of Moses having to hold up his hands is that although Joshua might be leading the people, Moses continues to be their leader. So Joshua is the war leader, but Moses continues to be the leader, and it has to be through Moses that the victory is granted. And so Moses' hands are symbolic of Israel's dependence upon God. But there's a scroll that has to be written, God says to Moses. Something to be remembered, that Joshua must remember, because the Amalekites come under the judgment of God. So this people, for attacking the Israelites when they're vulnerable, when they're in the desert, God declares that he will blot out their name from under heaven. The altar that Moses builds is called "The Lord is my banner." A banner, of course, flying above an army in battle, because hands were lifted up against the throne of the Lord, or possibly to the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war with the Amalekites from generation to generation. So there's probably a pun here. The Amalekites have lifted up their hands against God, but Moses lifted up his hands to God. And so there's a beautiful picture here in that sense, isn't there, of people who try to fight against God and against God's purpose. And for a period of time, God allows them to be victorious. But as soon as Moses is lifting up his hands to God in prayer, then God delivers his people. And this is how God works, isn't it? It's not that God needs our prayers in order to work through us or to work on our behalf, but God asks for our prayers. He seeks our prayers. It's through prayer that God's power becomes effective in our lives and through us to serve God. Exodus chapter 18 then, verse 1. Now Jethro, the priest of Midian and father-in-law of Moses, heard of everything God had done for Moses and for his people Israel, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. After Moses had sent away his wife Zipporah, his father-in-law Jethro received her and her two sons. One was named Gershom, for Moses said, "I have become a foreigner in a foreign land." And the other was named Eleazar, for he said, "My father's God was my helper. He saved me from the sword of Pharaoh." Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, together with Moses' sons and wife, came to him in the wilderness where he was camped near the mountain of God. Jethro had sent word to him, "I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons." So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him. They greeted each other and then went into the tent. Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and about all the hardships they had met along the way, and how the Lord had saved them. Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hands of the Egyptians. He said, "Praise be to the Lord, who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh, and who rescued the people from the hands of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods, for he did this to those who had treated Israel arrogantly." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God. The next day Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, while all these people stand around you from morning till evening?" Moses answered him, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and instructions." Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you are doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them his decrees and instructions, and show them the way they are to live and how they are to behave. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties and tens. Let them serve as judges for the people at all times, but let them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter because they will share it with you. If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied." Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. He chose capable men from all Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties and tens. They served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided themselves. Then Moses sent his father-in-law on his way, and Jethro returned to his own country. Now, we've seen already in this episode the ways that Moses needed to depend on others, Joshua to be the war leader, Aaron and Hur to lift up Moses' hands, the elders of Israel to stand with Moses as he struck the rock for the water to come forth. Now it's Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, who comes to the fore. Jethro hears about what has happened, and now he brings Moses' wife and his sons to meet him. But that's not all that Jethro brings with him. And we learn here the sons, the names of the sons of Moses. One is called Gershom, which sounds like the Hebrew for a foreigner there, because Moses had become a foreigner in a foreign land when he lived in Midian. And the other was named Eliezer, which means God is my helper, because Moses said, "My father's God was my helper." He had saved him from the sword of Pharaoh. Now, whether this means that Moses gave these names to the sons at this point, that may be the case, certainly with the second son, Eliezer, with Gershom. We read about him already in Exodus 2. You might remember verse 22, where it talks about Zipporah giving birth to him and Moses giving him that name because he was a foreigner. So it seems that Zipporah might have been pregnant whenever Moses left to go back to Egypt. We don't exactly know. But now Jethro has reunited this family unit. And then the reason I suggest that, by the way, is that the name, if it's because God saved Moses from the sword of Pharaoh, then that must be after the deliverance from Egypt. So perhaps this son has not yet been named by his father until this point. But anyway, Jethro comes with the sons, with Moses' sons and wife, in the desert near the mountain of God, verse 5. And Jethro had sent word already to say that he was coming. Moses comes out and greets Jethro, verse 7, and then tells his father-in-law everything that God has done and about the hardships and how God has faithfully delivered them step by step, verse 8. And Jethro is unsurprisingly delighted to hear. And his response is to praise Yahweh, praise the Lord who rescued them. And he says, verse 11, "Now he knows that the Lord is greater than all other gods, because he did this to those who treated Israel arrogantly." Now, there's two important things here. First of all, does this mean that it's at this point that Jethro comes to worship God? I think that seems unlikely. Remember, he's a Midianite. He's also descended from Abraham. And so it seems likely that he worshipped the God that Abraham worshipped, whether he knew the name Yahweh or not. We don't know. But I think the implication here is that Jethro, even though he was a priest of God, was maybe devoted to Yahweh in a special way, to the God of Abraham in a special way. he didn't necessarily believe that that was the only God, or that that Yahweh was God for all peoples or over all rivals. He may have thought that Yahweh was simply the God of the descendants of Abraham, of the Israelites and those other nations. But it's what has happened, it's what he hears about, what God has done, that convinces him that God is truly greater than all other gods. So again, there's a question there. Does he still believe that there are other gods? Has he not yet realized that God is the only true God? Of course, in saying all other gods, as the Old Testament does at times, it doesn't necessarily mean believing in other gods, but saying that there are other gods that people worship. They may not exist as gods. From the biblical perspective, they are false gods, they're idols. But of course, there are demonic powers and forces behind those idols. So they do exist in one sense, but they are no rival to the true God, the God of Israel, who is the God of heaven and of earth, the true God, the Creator. The other point here is that what happens to Jethro is a model of what should happen through Israel. Other people are meant to hear about what happens to Israel and come to faith in God. You see that later on when you get into Joshua. Rahab, for example, hears and she believes in the God of Israel because of what God has done for Israel. And so this is a model of how Israel is meant to make God known to the nations. Never think that God chose Israel because he loved them and didn't love the other nations. God loved all of the nations. God loves all people. But he chooses Israel so that through them his blessing can come to all nations. Ultimately, that's going to happen through Christ, through the descendant of Abraham, the seed of Abraham, who will bring blessing to all nations. But even the nation of Israel is going to receive God's words and become the soil into which Christ can be born. But there will be people throughout the Old Testament who through Israel come to worship God, come to worship Yahweh. And so Jethro, the second thing that he brings is a burnt offering. So he's brought Moses' sons and his wife to Moses. Then verse 12 tells us he brings a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God. Again, this shouldn't surprise us because, of course, sacrifice runs right back to the time of Cain and Abel and Noah after the flood sacrifices. And Abraham and others knew about the principle of sacrifice as the basis for worshipping God. So it shouldn't surprise us that Jethro should know this, who is a priest and who is a descendant of Abraham. But it's also significant in the sense that Jethro is the one bringing these offerings and sacrifices. Aaron is mentioned specifically coming with all the elders to eat the meal with Moses' father-in-law, because Aaron, of course, is going to become the high priest in Israel. He's the one who's going to be given the sacrificial system as a way to lead God's people in worship of him. Sacrifices certainly express thanksgiving in this case, but they'll take on a fuller significance, as the Passover already has, in a sense, the Passover where the lamb dies instead of the firstborn. But it becomes clearer as the law is given later on in Exodus that sacrifices have that symbolism of substitution, of taking the place. Well, the third thing that Jethro brings, he brings the sons and wife of Moses, he brings the sacrifices, and then thirdly, he brings some advice to Moses. The next day, Moses gets up to judge the people, and we see here how Moses needs to learn from Jethro. Moses is burning himself out. He's going to tire himself out and the people, because the people have to wait so long to speak to Moses about the disputes and questions that they have. Moses says, it's, well, people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it's brought to me and he decides. But Jethro shows Moses a more efficient way to organize the people. So Jethro has a lot to contribute here. Sacrifice, even though it will become clearer in the when the law is given, its significance. Family for Moses, but also here, a system of organization. That's going to become important. You get the sense that Moses was perhaps a natural leader, but As often with natural leaders, it's often said people who are dynamic leaders often struggle to delegate, to share responsibility with others. But Moses has to organize the people into thousands, hundreds, fifties and tens, and the elders, or at least capable men, verse 21, men who fear God and are trustworthy and hate dishonest gain, will serve as judges over them. And only the complex cases need to come to Moses. Moses needs to learn to delegate and to depend on others. Now, sometimes this is used as an example of Christian leadership. And I think there is something in that, certainly in terms of the qualities of the men that are chosen in verse 21. Because if you compare those with the qualities that are expected in 1 Timothy and in Titus for elders and overseers in the church, you'll see they're quite similar. People who fear God, who know God, people who are trustworthy, people who hate dishonest gain. That's a very important principle. It's there in the pastoral epistles, as I've mentioned. It's also there in Ephesians 20 and in 1 Peter 5, perhaps one of the most important qualities for leaders amongst God's people. But I think where this breaks down as an image of Christian leadership is that it's a very hierarchical system because Moses is at the top. But in the church, it's not Moses or any person at the top. It is Jesus. It is a person, but it's the risen, ascended Lord who is the head of the church. And so even if there has to be a system of organization and of leadership and of people appointed to take responsibility, at the top of that must be Christ. So there is plurality in Christian leadership. Moses is leading in a different period of time. He's leading a nation. He's not leading a church. A church is a family, a community of God's people who fellowship together. It doesn't need to be hierarchical. There does need to be structure. There do need to be people who take responsibility for guiding and leading the people under God. But they don't need a Moses figure because Christ takes the place of Moses. Don't forget the uniqueness of Moses in the Old Testament. And at this time, of course, as a nation on the move, they need a strong leader at the top. So there may be situations in Christian leadership, perhaps in parachurch organizations, perhaps in times of crisis, where strong leadership by individuals is needed, but it must never take the place of Christ, who is the head of the church. So three things that Jethro brought to Moses: family, sacrifices, and organization.